Welcome to Coaching and Cocktails, the podcast.
Okay, welcome, welcome. And this is Coaching and Cocktails, the podcast. This is Tina. I do not have Brandy with me today because it's past her bedtime even more than it is mine. But I do have some really exciting special guests again. I'm really excited to have with me Sean Sully Sullivan, otherwise known as The Legend with the OCB. I didn't give you that name. Apparently other people gave you that name, so you can laugh all you want. And Marjorie Thrash, both from the OCB. So I'm going to let you guys kind of quickly introduce yourselves and your role in the OCB for people who don't know, although I don't know how anybody doesn't know at this point. But anyway, go ahead. Sully, why don't you tell everybody who you are, and then Marjorie can tell everybody who she is.
You just nailed it. I'm Sully. Apparently I'm a legend to somebody, so that's good enough. So I'm just a guy that's been around the sport since I was 13 years old. I've been involved in every capacity from coaching, competing at all levels, promoting, deeply involved with the OCB from its inception. Before that, I was deeply involved with the ANBC, American Natural Bodybuilding Conference, helped with that organization. Just really have gotten more out of the sport of bodybuilding than you can imagine. I mean, it basically has drawn me in because it pretty much single-handedly changed the course of my life. It had given me the opportunity to make lifelong friends, to see the way that the sport can do everything from empower people to go to new heights. It's just a wonderful thing to be around. On the flip side, I'm a retired police officer. I was a SWAT team commander and detective, and did all that for 25 years and left that to go back into military full time. And I am in the Air National Guard for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And I have a pretty cool position with them. Best job ever. So I basically can say that my life does not suck. I have the greatest hobby profession in the world in bodybuilding, and the greatest profession in the world of helping lead America's finest young men and women on their path to greatness in the United States Air Force.
And I will say you are a legend in all aspects that you just mentioned, because you know, you were a huge influence on me and my husband, right, in the sport. And you are 1,000% correct that the sport absolutely led me. Had I not found bodybuilding, had I not found other people as passionate about it as you were when I first entered into the sport in the early 2000s, I would still probably be working for the federal government and making a good living and not loving what I do every day as a coach, you know, which is what I get to do now and get to hang out with like people who are equally as passionate about it. But you know, you were very influential in that. I know for me, getting into the sport myself. So, you know, you are a legend. Just admit that you're a legend.
No, I will not.
Oh, he's so humble. Marjorie.
Totally. He is. That's the most I've heard him say about himself, because usually he'll just say, I'm just a guy.
I'm just a guy.
He just stops there. I'm Marjorie Thrash. I get the pleasure of working with Sully and my mentor, Matt Shepley, and Frank and Chad, who all work behind the scenes making the OCB move forward each day. My role is the director of marketing and public relations. And I started competing in 2013, came over to the OCB in 2014, went around the sport a little bit, saw some things, came back to OCB because I just fell in love with the sport and OCB and believe in the mission that we work towards every day. So I do the social media and I help promoters get their events off the ground, and I get to lean on people like Sully, who's been around here for a long time. He's seen it all. As he says, he knows where all the bodies are buried. So I'm learning where they are.
I know where some of them are buried. We got secrets, don't we, Sully?
We put a few in.
some of the shenanigans from up in Massachusetts, our days in Massachusetts. Ooh.
Yeah, there's some stories over when the cameras go off and we have a few more cocktails.
There are some stories that should not be told publicly.
Never.
Oh, there's good times. Good times. Good times. Oh. So Marjorie, what do you do in your spare time when you're not running all the stuff for the OCB? Because I know you have a whole life outside of the OCB.
That I do. I am a science teacher. I've been a science teacher for over 20 years. I taught in New York State for several years, been teaching in Virginia for over 18 years. I have two teenage boys, one who's a senior in high school like yours this year, they're graduating.
How are you surviving that, by the way? I meant to ask you.
Every day I look at him, I'm like, don't leave me. He's been my ride or die since birth, you know, and he's like, oh, that's okay. You'll have Miles. Miles is 15 and he's like my husband's mini me, and Carter is like my mini me. So they're great kids. I'm really lucky. I just feel like I just got lucky because they're so easy to raise. They're awesome kids. And cool. I have a husband who's a professor. And so we're all in academia and all that stuff. So that's my other life. Yeah.
That's also a very awesome life, right? I mean, you both are very, very commendable in helping to bring up a whole other generation of humans, right? And helping to develop other human beings, which is a very underpaid and underrated and underappreciated, I think, oftentimes. But I'm sure the people whose lives that you each touch, like they appreciate you. And I know I appreciate that you guys are on with me today so we can talk OCB fun. I mean, I too have been around the sport. I have, been around just about every federation there is, at least if they existed anywhere along the, you know, East Coast the OCB always felt like family. It's where I started. So it's sort of, where Eric and I, my husband, Eric and I both come back to. So, you know, we judge, we coach, you know, we do all the fun things. And so we're happy to support you guys because I know that you're on a mission to really do what's best for the sport and the athletes. And I know that you're really, really athlete focused, right? So I'm losing my words. It's late at night. So if my words don't come, Marjorie can fill in because she's the smarty pants teacher. And sometimes sometimes words are hard for me. But yeah, so I'm glad that you guys are here. I wanted to give you guys, so we have some questions from some of our folks that sent them in ahead of time, but what's going on with the OCB in 2022? I almost said 2023, but we're not there yet. I guess I'm trying to skip through this year and I don't know why. But yeah, so tell me what's going on.
Well, last time we spoke, but we were talking about how we were just coming off the heels of 2020 and how we barely had some shows, but we were really proud of the ones that we managed to have. And this last year was a big rebound year for us and being able to host more of our events. And what was cool was seeing seeing our promoters move out of those hotel venues and back onto the real stage and giving the athletes the experience that OCB is known for. So we're really happy to see that happen. I think we had over 70 shows. So our season started a little bit later. Usually we're closer to 100, but we managed to have that. And the Yorton Cup, I had the pleasure of promoting for the first time this year. And I told Matt Shepley that I felt like it was a hazing experience because let's give her a pandemic. Let's give her the possibility that we might have some social distancing or that the event could be canceled. Well, you know what? Let's rule out four states that won't talk to her to book a venue for the event. And so we ended up in Pittsburgh, and a lot of people kind of were like, Pittsburgh, you know, and they rolled their eyes.
Like, I was one of them. I was one of them because I was like, first of all, I'd never been to Pittsburgh, but so I only knew what I had to go on because people are like, they call it Shittsburgh. I don't know why. I'd never been.
I know.
I liked it there, but I'm the oddball.
I will say it had nothing to do with Yorton Cup itself. Mm-hmm. I will say I don't feel the need to go back. I don't, unless your cup is there again and I have to go, I don't think I'm going there to vacation or just to visit anytime soon. No offense to Pittsburgh people, wasn't my favorite, but I commend you for being able to find a venue, right? That you were able to hold your income at.
And it wasn't just a venue. I think anybody who, you know, who wondered how we ended up there. And on that day, when they walked in the venue, the jaws dropped and nobody said another word other than like, wow, because it was gorgeous. And I'm really,
and I kind of helped. And I kind of helped on the venue end when we were looking at the venues, because I had competed there twice, once for the AAU Mr. America and once for the AMBC National Championship. So two different federations, you know, 8 years apart. So I'd been there twice over a decade span, and it had stuck with me, you know, after doing 150 competitions over 30-year span, you know, you'd think you forget most of them, but I remembered those two events because of the venue. And maybe it's my military background, but I just knew the venue was going to be like really, really cool venue. Great place to walk around. I knew the athletes would love it. Now, you know, I happen to like Pittsburgh. Of course, I kind of grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania, which is just, you know, a little ways away. So I guess I'm a little biased, but yeah, it was difficult trying to pull that off in a COVID year. But I'm just proud of Marjorie and the team for pulling it off. And I have to say Marjorie and the team, because we try to do the Yorkin Cup as a team effort. You know, Marjorie was the one that was kind of pretty much holding the bag, but we're all there together to support her. And only one of us didn't make it because his military duties at the last minute
Same guy that didn't make it to his own show that he promoted in Nashville?
Yes.
Was it that guy?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm telling you, this, my new job, you know, in
I was like, Sully, I want to come to Nashville and judge your show and hang out with you in Nashville. I get to Nashville, Sully's like, I'm not going to make
I had every plan in the world, but then that was the week that I was ascending into my position. And then, you know, we had trips after that. And it was just, it was crazy. But I will be there next year at the Yorkin Cup in its new location.
Well, what Sully contributed was huge, because after seeing me rejected, how many times did I send you rejection emails ignored again? He suggested it and he's like, just trust me on this. Just trust me on this. And so Chad Austin flew out there with me. We toured the venue together and we were like, we both got goosebumps when we walked in. So we knew it was going to be okay. So Sully, thank you. Stacey Longo let us ship everything to her house. So we wouldn't have been able to pull it off if it had not been a team effort from start to finish. And there was definitely space to social distance, because that was one of the things we were worried about.
I thought it worked well. I mean, it was a great venue. And you know, considering everything you had to, the hoops you had to jump through to do it. I mean, the hazing. So you've been hazed. So hopefully this year will, hopefully this year won't say, hold my beer.
Yeah.
you.
So with that being said, this year we are going to move the show south to Charlotte, North Carolina, and we moved it back to September. You know, as you know, at the end of the contest season for all these organizations, the shows are all just like on top of each other. We felt it's important to separate from the pack and have our own event and not fight for a weekend. You know, it's just and be in our own place. So we're really excited about Charlotte. North Carolina has been a great state for us. We have some really strong promoters down there. We're starting to grow in the Southeast. It'll make it more accessible to the competitors in Georgia and Florida and Alabama. And Charlotte's just a great city. So the venue is only 6.5 miles from the airport, really easy to access. It's a gorgeous venue. Chad Austin traveled there and walked through and took videos, and then we had the Carters go and do the same thing. And so, you know, really, if it were not like a whole team effort, an event like that, it would be impossible to do yourself. You know, it's just,
oh, sure.
We're just so lucky to have a lot of talent in the OCB and people who are really passionate about it and make it happen. So we're excited about Charlotte. It should be fun.
Let me ask you this. Oh, go ahead, Sully.
Oh, I was just going to say, in this year for the OCB, it is going to be a professional only show. It is. We are no longer going to have the amateur component.
Right. I'm excited about that.
It is going to be, as a matter of fact, I think, I don't think there are any other pro show onlys in natural bodybuilding.
Not that I know.
But it's something we thought long and hard about. You know, when you start getting 200 competitors, the shows drag out and, you know, you mix them up. So we really wanted to just have something for just our pros to just really just highlight them. Make it their day. So we're not rushing them off the stage because we have 10 other classes to come out. It is their day. It is their event. It's about them that day. So we try to find the best possible venue with the best possible lighting, some pretty kick-ass awards. I almost want to come back and compete so I can get one of those Chet York medallions. And they have their own day.
That's awesome. So I do have a question for you about Yorton this year, because I know you had taken out the requirement that you have to qualify. you have to qualify for it as a, yes. I mean, yes, you already have to be a pro, but are you making people qualify for it this year as far as like competing as a pro prior? What is the qualification?
So anybody, so first of all, the payout is going up, and that is our goal. To each year, to the best of our ability, be able to increase the payouts as our shows grow and the organization grows, invest back into the athletes. And so this year, the payout will be $54,000 total, $5,000 for first place, $3,000 for second, and $1,000 for third place for the overall pros for each of the six pro categories. Pros who competed this last year at the Yorton Cup and placed in the top three of their class. So if you were in the short class and you were in the top three, so meaning you went up for the overall, maybe you didn't win any cash prizes, but you went up for the overall, you're automatically qualified this year. So you will not need to go out and qualify and compete again before you get back on stage again. Anyone who earns their pro card, who earned it at the Yorton Cup this year as an amateur, or after, is going to automatically qualify for the Yorton Cup. So if you earn your pro card this year, you are qualified for the 2022 Yorton Cup. Okay. If you are a pro we haven't seen in a while,
you have to compete as a pro in another show first.
You're going to need to qualify and place top five in your class. So
top five, okay.
It's time to dust off those shoes, get out the trunks. and so we did front load the pro schedule. And we have a lot more pro shows on the schedule, so that will make it a little bit easier for people to get out there and qualify for the Yorton Cup this year. So, you know, that is going to raise the quality of the pros. It's going to increase the quality of the pros, and it's going to make it more competitive. We really want to see the cream of the crop.
Although, I saw what was on Yorton this year, and I was like, do we raise the quality more than that? Is that a thing? I was like,
I don't know.
I know I was sitting there like, really, I should put these fucking gummy bears away because who are these people? Because nobody looked like that when I was competing. Sully, you can attest to this. Nobody.
I didn't look like that.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, I haven't competed since 2012, but nobody looked like that. Like, who are these people? Yes, what's happening?
The consistency incredible. Across the board in all the, in every category, the consistency of the athletes being, you know, as far as conditioning and presentation, meeting the symmetry requirements of each of the different categories was just, it was off the chain. I mean, again, I wasn't there. I'm going by videos and photos.
Well, I was there. But and I was front and center, and I can tell you ridiculous. It was insanity.
It was. Well, and each pro class was judged up there for over 20 minutes. I mean, it was intensely competitive.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that we had talked about as an organization in the highest pro show is we looked at two different models. And model A is trying to have as many pros in a pro show as possible so you can say, hey, we had 150 people compete in the XYZ event. And we thought about that. We looked back at what was the intent of professional bodybuilding and what distinguished the greatest shows, like the Mr. Olympia when it came about. Well, you had to qualify, and it was, the top 10 in each category, the top 10 figure, the top 10 this. It wasn't a show of, of 200 people competing together. So we really wanted to kind of try to do that and not play a numbers game, try to play a, you know, you need to qualify, you need to get up there, you need to really, really bring your A game. Because if they're competing more in the other pro shows, they're going to be elevating their game at that level and then continuing the path of progress, elevating themselves to the next level. And this is just due to competition. The more you compete and the more you compete in, the better you get, because the better the competition gets around you. So that by the time you get to the level of the Yorton Cup, bodybuilders and figure athletes and all the competitors will have improved 2 to 5% over the year before as a collective group, because they've had to go through that qualification process. They've had to stay on their A game. They've had to improve and they've had to excel. And it's just going to elevate the quality of the athletes. They're going to amaze themselves. And you think it's crazy now? In 5 more years, you're not even going to recognize the sport again. They're going to be like that much better.
Freaks of nature.
People are really are.
People ask all the time, will you ever get back on stage? I was like, fuck no.
Like, I can't. Like, you and I am
at an age where I don't even have the potential to look like that anymore, right? Like, I don't know that I had that potential when I was younger. I definitely don't have it at almost 50.
And people have asked me the same thing, and I say, I'm on stage 3 times a year. I stand there and I post their hands up and I go, hey, look at this person.
I'm just going to put my athletes on stage, and that is So that,
you know, I feel the same way. And like, you know, I'm a one hit wonder. It was intensely competitive. And so, you know, like Sully was saying, we're not chasing numbers. And this is why, you know, OCB doesn't, one of the reasons why we're not open to accepting pros from all organizations.
Yeah, it's quality over quantity.
Correct.
Right. It's not just about making money and bringing in a bunch of people. It is about making sure that what you're doing is taken seriously. It's looked at as a serious sport. And it's not just like, oh yeah, we'll have 300 people. Right. And, you know, 3/4 of them look like they needed to diet another year.
Exactly. Exactly.
And we know it does. I know the appearance and I've heard some of the comments, but it's just our business model. We just did it for a reason. It's not to exclude or it's to one up or to say we're better than anybody else. It's just the way we decide to run our particular business. And
We know how we drug test. We know how we award pro cards. So we have our quality control in place. And, you know, we just don't want to be accountable for anybody else, but we know what what we can control within our domain and
we focus on our own house.
Exactly. And I will say, and you know, I have relationships with people in other federations and friends
Absolutely. You know, I know you do, Sully.
And, you know, we have for years. But what I always try to explain to people, and because I am a business person, we own two small businesses, right? I have worked in corporate America. I understand how business works. This is a fucking business, okay? It's like, yes. So I can get pissed that the fucking Jiffy Lube down the street wants to charge me $25. What am I going to do? Am I going to fight with them because they're not getting along with the fucking other, you know, the other place that does oil changes down the street because they're not working together? That doesn't make any sense, right? So if we're talking about things as a business, you guys, that's just it. You focus on your organization. You focus on what is going to make your competitors, happy, because they are the patrons of your business, right? We as coaches are the patrons of your business. Mm-hmm. If you don't like the business, you go to another business, right? Exactly. If I do not like the muffins at Starbucks, I will go to Dunkin' Donuts, right? It's not that big of a deal. And everybody makes it so personal, and it's not. And if you're a business person, you understand that that's how this works.
Thank you. And that's a simplicity of it. Taco Bell doesn't focus on anything other than Taco Bell. Mm-hmm. They don't worry about what Wendy's is doing or what Burger King is doing or whatever. They focus on being the best Taco Bell they possibly can be.
Right.
And that's all we're doing. We're just trying to be the, you know, I'm not worried about Wendy's, Burger King, or McDonald's. I'm just trying to make the best tacos that we possibly can. Can you tell? Right. I'm thinking about Mexican food.
I mean, I'm a little hungry.
And all I'm thinking about, and I'm thinking about Starbucks. I'm already on breakfast.
I had Starbucks today and shouldn't have because now the caffeine is probably going to kill me. But all right, so I know you guys have a couple other new things going on this year. So you added the wellness category. So
yes.
And I know there have been some questions about why and how. And how's this going to play out? And I know even my own clients, right, are just kind of like, I want to see how this is going to play out. So some people were kind of excited. We're going to say like cautiously optimistic kind of thing. But what was the rationale behind that?
I'm going to take this one because I kind of grabbed this one by the horns about a year ago because people had been asking about wellness. You know, can you add wellness? Can you add wellness? Can you add wellness? And about a year and a half ago, we talked about it. And we were like, no, we're going to dismiss it. We have too much going on. We didn't really understand the focus of wellness. And over that period of time, over this past year and a half, I decided to take a look at wellness. What is wellness? What could wellness be? And is there an avenue for wellness? Is there a place for wellness as a category? The more I started to absorb and digest and actually see what the ideal physique for wellness was, then I started going to events and I started looking at shows and I started looking at, you know, particularly the women's categories. And I started to go, okay, the way that I look at judging is that the first criteria that every category has to meet is symmetry, because symmetry is the balance and proportion of parts that are pleasing to the eye. But symmetry for bodybuilding and for women's physique and men's, for each category, what accounts for symmetry is totally different. Okay. Muscularity and definition and size, all that stuff can factor in as well into various aspects of each category, but it's all based on symmetry, the balance of the body, the wholeness of the parts. So I started focusing on that and I started watching the categories and I started seeing these competitors that I was judging that were no way bikini body, or they were no way a figure body. Mm-hmm. And the figure girl that would never fit in the bikini, and the bikini girl that would never fit in the figure, and neither of them would ever fit into classic or into women's physique. And I went, you guys are the physique match that would go into the wellness category. And we've all seen it. We've all seen a competitor on stage, say in the figure category, that has a very, very well-developed lower body. And you're judging that competitor. And you, Tina, would understand this as a judge. But you can tell that their upper body will never, ever, ever have the lat width or the shoulder separation or the shoulder size ever necessary to be a figure competitor. But at the same time, you can look at their physique and go, they have too much lower body development. The glutes are too round and too overdeveloped. They'll never fit in ideally the bikini. So what do we do for feedback for that person? Where do we have them go? Are we going to have them continue to enter physique competition and not place well and fail, knowing that they can never improve? Or is there a venue out there? Is there an avenue? Is the place where that person can now go and fit and excel and empower themselves and move up in the placings and feel better about themselves? So we were judging a show and I called Marjorie over to the judging table and I said, Marjorie, what do you think? You know, I pointed a couple of competitors out to her and she was like, yeah. And I go, and she looked at me and she went, they would be in wellness. I'm like, that's what wellness would look like. So now we have an avenue for that. Mm-hmm. Another thing is my show in February in Atlantic City is going to be the first show that we've added the wellness. Well, I have five competitors for the wellness category. I have the same number of competitors entered right now. I have 60 competitors entered at 4 weeks out. Last year and the year before, I had 60 competitors entered at 4 weeks out. I have the same number of competitors. I actually have more bikini and figure than I've had in years past. So it's not taking from anything. Mm-hmm. And when I'm talking to the competitors, I'm talking to competitors that didn't do well in figure or didn't do well in bikini because they were told that their lower body development overpowers them, or that their glutes and their legs are too big for bikini, or they were told these things. Now they have a home. Mm-hmm. So that's why we added the wellness division. We didn't want to add something that's going to make a show longer because the shows are long enough, and we weren't trying to add a gimmick play. So what is wellness? Well, the first thing, what wellness is not, to dispel a rumor. It is not a place for people to go who did not have an opportunity to diet for a competition, because you're going to be held to a leanness standard. It's not a place to go for people who don't train with weights, because your lower body development would have to be, a greater amount of development in a lower body than you would have in bikini. It's going to consist of quarter turns. The rear pose is going to be the same as the bikini pose. Your front pose is going to be a little bit off altered, but your side pose is going to be very similar to the figure pose. So it's going to be composed of quarter turns, where your body is going to be judged on its density. It's meeting the symmetry requirements for what we determine wellness to be. Do you have the right amount of muscle tone? There's no walk to the curtain or any of that walk stuff back at all like that. So it is actually going to be a judged athletic event. I'm really excited to see how it goes. But with all things, we know it's a new division and it's new to us. Mm-hmm. They're going to be growing pains and there's going to be learning curves as it gains its momentum. But that's why we added it, because we realize that there truly is a place for women who genetically don't have that predisposed physique that's going to allow them to excel in figure. Mm-hmm. And they have far too much lower body development to do well in bikini.
Yeah. And so, as a coach, adding my two cents, right? Because I'm the first one to admit that even when bikini came on the scene 100 years ago, I was like, what the fuck? I was like, really?
Me too.
I was like, okay. Like, and as a coach, I was like, how am I supposed to teach people how to like stick their ass out and like be sexy on stage, right? Like, give me the art. Anyway, that was my attitude at first. But of course, I grew to love it. And now I think I love bikini more. I like doing bikini posing more than anything. And if I ever did come back to the stage, I'd be like, yeah, I'm going to do bikini. But, you know, it was kind of the same. I wasn't quite there with wellness, but I was like, okay, here we go. Here's another one that's, you know, it's just going to, so I'm just telling you my initial thoughts were, it's just going to confuse things more. It's, you know, it's just going to be a more gray area. But then after I sat and thought about it and I sort of thought through some of my own clients, I thought through things that, you know, I see on stage and I've seen over the years. And I actually have two, maybe three clients that fit perfectly into the category. You know, I had to think about it. You know, the amount of times I've given a competitor feedback, just like you're saying, Sully, you know, I've had athletes myself or that I've judged on stage, and it's not just a matter of building wider lats. Structurally, people, men and women, right? You're just not, you know, your physical bone structure is only going to allow you to build so much as far as your lats go, right? And so in order for you to be competitive in figure or, you know, even physique, right? Like, you have to be able to have this nice big X frame. And some people just aren't going to have that. I think a lot about my former soccer players. So many of them fit into this because their lower bodies are so muscular, right? They're so developed in their lower bodies. The upper body structurally doesn't fit either figure or bikini. So, you know, I agree with you, Sully, and I've heard the same rumblings, like, well, people just need to work longer and people just need to build harder, and it's for people who don't work their upper body. And I'm like, well, that's fucking bullshit, because if you've actually looked at the picture at like what, you know, these are clearly very muscularly developed and there is a level of conditioning that's expected. So, you know, I do think there's going to be some growing pains, as there always is, but
was a classic physique. Remember posing was a hot mess?
And, you know, but I think that this will actually help to delineate things more. So if it goes appropriately, it will give those women who were too muscular competing in bikini and not structurally fit and muscular enough for figure a place to go, so that maybe we can delineate the categories even better, because these poor women just didn't really have a place where they fit necessarily. So I'm hopeful, right? But I can't convince any clients to do it just yet, even though I tried really hard, because they all want to wait and see.
Once they see it, once we have more examples, you know, from Sully's show, we're going to have some more photos and great examples of it and posing. I think it's going to put a lot of that, you know, those question marks to rest. But like, I was iffy about it too. I was the first, when I first heard about it and people were asking me, I was like, oh no, we're not offering that ever. Why? Symmetry, hello. And so my brain was there too. And it wasn't until, Sully jumped on the train before I did. And I was a little slower about it. I'm like, oh my gosh, I do not want to add another category. Like I was really digging my heels in. But then, not only was Sully pointing out situations in events with athletes on stage, but when I was in the gym, I was looking at how women were training and what fitness looks like today and what does it look like? Does it just look like women's bodybuilding? Because that's all there was in the beginning. And if we hadn't branched out and added bikini or figure, where would this sport be? Mm-hmm. So if we can expand it and what fitness looks like, and include more people, then that grows the sport, yeah, right?
Absolutely.
And the really nice thing that I've seen and the comments that I've received, the people who went over to another organization who now want to come back. And if they're coming back to compete naturally, that is a win for the sport.
Yeah.
And so, what I was most curious about was the data. And I said, Sully, well, tell me what your numbers are. I just want to know where's bikini. Where's we're like, are we pulling from something else? Like what's happening? Because the data tells it all. Mm-hmm. If the event is growing, then you're bringing in new people who may not have competed before.
Right. Now because they can see themselves in it, right? Like they may have looked at bikini and was like, yep, don't see myself there.
I'm never going to look like that.
I'm never going to look like that. I don't have this shape. So where I don't quite fall anywhere. So, I'm excited to kind of see how it all plays out. Maybe I'll eventually convince one of my athletes to do it. I have one in particular. I'm just like, this one's made for you. Like literally former soccer player. I was like, this is your
cyclists, gymnasts, soccer players,
you're right. No, absolutely.
Dancers, even a lot of dancers.
I'm there. I'm all for it. I wasn't at first, but I came around.
Yeah, no, neither was I. And I'm being completely honest. I was a late bloomer to the wellness club.
and I've also heard, what are you going to add another category for men too? No, I don't think we need that. But here's another way to look at it. 60% of our sport is women.
Yep.
With having 10% more of the sharehold of numbers on stage, wouldn't it behoove us to give the extra consideration? Also, a women's physique is far different than a men's, as far as your general genetic structure. There are a lot more differences in women's physique, a lot more nuance, shall we say, that can be had. So I do think that there is room for this fourth category. For those women that didn't fit into the other three categories, they have a home. And we want to provide that. I mean, we want to, give them that opportunity.
Yep. I'm looking forward to it. You guys ready to jump in some of the questions?
Let's.
And then if there's anything else that you guys feel like that was important for this year that I missed, make sure you let me know before we hop off of here.
Okay.
But, all right, let's see what we have. That one I'm not reading. All right. Oh, here's a good one. What is the rationale for changing the women's master's age and not the men's?
Well, originally the OCB was set to 35.
It was because I earned my pro card when I was 35.
And technically, my master's. And technically, if you define what a master's competitor is, it's defined as 35 plus. When we look at the data and the competitors that are competing in our shows, if you look at the demographics age-wise, the vast majority are falling within certain age ranges, which means that after a certain point, people just aren't really competing anymore, whereas the men are competing for a much longer period of time. And that's what the data shows.
So the rationale is based on data. And look, I appreciate that you guys collect all this data because I am a total data geek. Like if you saw the spreadsheets I kept on my clients and my business and like everything else, plus I did data in my former life with the government. So I appreciate that you're not just like, well, let's try this and let's try that. And you're actually crunching numbers and like, this is what makes sense. So I think it's important for people to hear and understand that. And I think I think that it was 35 when I earned my pro card, and I know mm-hmm. you guys flipped it to 40 when I think it was when you started when you merged with, you know, another federation. Mm-hmm. Yes. And now you're kind of going back to the roots of what it was. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. Like historically sure. it was 35 plus. Yes. And I could,
because some promoters can offer 40 plus classes. It's just not going to be a pro qualifier. So
right,
if people are looking for that, that's absolutely still, you know, offered.
Right. And I think there'll still be 50 plus classes for women sure. too. And that shows that,
there will be.
Yeah. They're just not, you know, a pro qualifier. And right. you know, in fact, I was talking to Bobby a little bit about this today, and, it's just that, you know, when you have these masters pro shows and everybody wants them, but then only two people show up, like what, you know, this, yeah. this will encourage more people to be able to fall right. into that master's category. So, I'm all for it. Dana says, good job.
And going back to, and just another sidebar caveat to that, going back to the initial, why was OCB initially 40 for men and 35 for women? And that was because Matt and I did a broad-based data analysis of hormonal profiles, aging of physique, all the analytics on it. And in at the time, we did it for a different reason, because the argument was the men should be 35 plus. And I was like, absolutely not. I was 40 years old at the time, and I'm winning open pro shows. I'm like, mm-hmm. no, we don't age the same way. But we went back and we looked at how women age, where the decline comes in. It made more sense. It was actually perfect. And Matt figured it out, but it was actually perfect for a woman at 37 and a man at 41. And I'm like, Matt, there's no way we're going to go 37 and 41. It's either going to be 35 and 40 or everything.
Yeah, we got to round up or down or something. Like, you can't.
He's a mathematician.
Oh,
so
I get it.
He's a statistician. I mean, he came up with it. But we literally sat down and we crunched numbers. We spent a whole year on that, crunching numbers. And that was the data that we had come up with, was that due to the aging decline and the way that fat tissues get added into a woman's physique. And an aspect of that is also from childbearing. The only three times in a female's life, or in a person's life, two for a male and three for a woman, where you can add fat cells is, you know, when you're going through your adolescence, then or through your baby stages, you know, your baby fat cells get added on, through your hormone surges when you're in your mid-teen years. And then the only other time that a fat cell can be added to the human body is during pregnancy. By the time a woman's 35, they've usually had one or two children. There are exceptions. I'm not saying that, you know, I don't want that to sound, you know, misogynistic, that women should have babies. That is not what I'm saying. But I'm just saying, as a normal role of life, most women do. Well, when you've gone through your pregnancy, you've added fat cells. So by the time you're 35, you have a harder time getting leaner and showing that physique than somebody at 25 or 28 or 29 does. That was one of the factors. There's just one of the remote factors that came in our research. I never knew that, you know, that the only other time, you know, in a human life cycle that you can add a fat cell is during pregnancy. I had no idea. It made sense. So that was why we initially had it at 35. Data really hasn't changed. So it just made sense to go back to what we were doing. And the numbers bear it out. The competition data bears it out too.
And what's interesting is that a lot of some people initially, their first response is like, oh my gosh, now I'm at this disadvantage because I'm 40, you know, too. Well, if you look, for example, at the Yorton Cup women's physique competitors this year, they were pushing 50, right? So yep. If you're talking about muscle maturity, if you're 35 and you're going up against a 40 plus competitor in figure or physique, you are at a disadvantage.
Yeah, I tell my clients this all the time, because, you know, as they're registering for shows, they're like, oh, well, I'm only going to do masters and yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to tell you that a lot of times the masters category is the toughest category to compete in, because you're talking about women with muscle maturity, right? I mean, it's just like, I'm like, don't assume that just because you're competing in that, you're just doing the masters, I'm like, that it's going to somehow be easier, because that is not the case. So, all right. So that was good. And I appreciate all the data, but I will say, from a scientific perspective, Sully, there is another time when you can add little baby fat cells. and that is during a massive refeeding. So competitors who gorge themselves after shows when they're very, very lean.
Oh.
This happens also when in people with like anorexia that are overfed too quickly. But that there is an opportunity there, and this is something I actually work with a lot of my clients on and trying to. But post show, when you're very, very lean and you're metabolically adapted, if you gorge and gorge and gorge, your body has the ability to make new little baby fat cells, which is why when you gain all that fat post show, it's even harder to lose that particular fat when you go to try to do it again. So that's my little science. There you go. There's my science tip for
that. That is interesting. I did not know that. Wow.
Yes. And it's called
the big brain on Tina.
It's called refeed syndrome, if you want to learn. That's what happens with anorexics and such. All right, so let's get back to this. Okay. Mm-hmm. Here's one. This is just a more fun one. How do you define bodybuilding? How is it different from regular weightlifting? Do you have to compete to be considered a bodybuilder? And what is the ratio of behavior and mindset? So this is just a conversational one. Like, how would you differentiate being a body, you know, how do you define bodybuilding, right? Like, is it just, are you a competitor if you're bodybuilding, or can you bodybuild without being a competitor? How does it all differentiate? Who wants to answer that?
Well, I'll start and I'll let Sully take over because he's been immersed in this. Mine will be short, but bodybuilding to me happens in the gym. It's not on the stage.
Yes.
It's the process of lifting weights to sculpt the physique that you want to build. Now, when you get into competing, what's different about that is you're not just sculpting the body that you want. You're trying to please a panel of judges to fit a certain criteria. So bodybuilding isn't necessarily competing. You're building muscle for you, putting it on your frame and enjoying the actual strength training and developing the body that you find pleasing. So Sully, you say he's going to add something really spectacular. So that was my short, sweet answer.
Nope. To me, bodybuilding is a mindset. Competitive bodybuilding is an athletic endeavor. One does not necessarily, you know, coincide with the other. So bodybuilding begins at the mindset and is carried out through diligent exercise and through proper nutrition. And this is why I find that bodybuilding, not competitive bodybuilding, not just competitive bodybuilding, but bodybuilding is so changing and so altering and so empowering. When bodybuilding came into my life through a chance encounter with Arnold Schwarzenegger, it gave me a perspective and something that I wanted to try to do to change my physique. Never thought it would lead to competition. I just wanted to have enhanced muscle tone, to have more self-confidence mm-hmm. and lower body fat so I could feel better about myself. That's what the mindset and the endeavor was to me. And once I realized that I could make those changes, I could change other aspects into my life, like, oh, perhaps improve my grades or, you know, have more confidence and do this and do that. And it empowered my whole life. Mm-hmm. So the reason I love bodybuilding is because it is a mindset, and when it is properly applied, it is a life-changing experience where competition is a one-day memorable event.
And Sully, I agree with both of you with both of what you said, and adding my own two cents into that. I mean, exactly that. I started bodybuilding to look good naked. I mean, I had this very thick, stocky physique my whole life. Like, I was never the skinny girl. And I just, my ex-husband was like, come work out with me in the gym. And I was like, I'm going to look like a man. You know, this is like when I was like 21, it'd be looking like a man. And, you know, and I started sculpting this physique with weights, and I was bodybuilding, and it was very much a mindset, and it was very much life-changing. And early on, people were like, you should compete, you should compete, you should compete, throughout my 20s, because I just naturally had a muscular physique or what have you. And I tell people all the time, just because you are a bodybuilder in the gym does not mean you should compete, right? Because that's a whole other thing, right? And it's something that drives me batshit crazy, because for some reason now, and this kind of leads to one of the other questions, is like how social media influences the sport, because now everybody feels like because you've picked up a weight a few times in the gym, you should compete. And that is where
or coach.
Don't even get me started on that. That's a whole other fucking podcast. But you know, that because there is that mindset aspect to it, right? It takes it to a whole other competitive level. Like I always tell people, because I like to flop around in the pool does not mean I should go be Michael Phelps in the Olympics, right? Like it just because I can swim doesn't mean like that's where I need to take it, right? Enjoy your time in the gym, enjoy sculpting your physique. It doesn't mean you have to take it to this other level. Like that has to be this incredible burning desire to want to be the hungriest you've ever been and the coldest you've ever been and the most irritable you've ever been and take on all of those challenges that come with that, you know, the mental challenges that come with getting on stage. So most people want what it looks like on stage without having to do the stuff that's in the middle between the gym and the stage. Right. And that's the stuff that's really hard, but that's also the stuff that is life altering. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the aspect of it. I know for me, not just lifting weights was empowering in and of itself, but getting into competing allowed me to overcome challenges I could have never dreamed I could overcome, right? And then the empowerment, the resilience, and the, you know, the perseverance and those skills that you build in yourself when you tackle something like that, an extreme sport of this nature, because that's what it is, right? So when I do consider it an extreme sport. And, you know, those lessons that you're able to take with you into every other aspect of your life, right?
I mean, especially as a woman, I feel.
Absolutely. 100%, Marjorie.
Because women were late to this sport. There wasn't a place for us. And so, like, I looked at pioneers, you know, that were doing this when really women in the weight room, it's not a common thing, right? Mm-hmm. Or women were just intimidated by going over to that section of the gym. I mean, I think every woman has felt like that at some point in her life. And it took like overcoming that fear to just go over to that side of the gym and just find your place there. And then it's empowering. And you feel like,
yes,
I can do this. I can do anything that right. I want to do.
Absolutely. No, that was the good answers. Well, how do you feel like social media influences perceptions of bodybuilding and what's it say, how this may be challenging to novices getting into the sport? So how do you feel about social media's impact on the sport as you've seen it? And Sully, you've seen it from before. So, mm-hmm. you know, from the beginning of time before social media even existed and I've watched it grow over social media as well. So what are your thoughts on that?
Marjorie's the social media guru, so I'm going to have her tackle this first.
It's a blessing and a curse. It's a double-edged sword.
I agree.
Because in so many ways, social media leveled the playing field for natural competitors because it made natural bodybuilding more visible. Whereas, you know, for decades, the untested shows dominated the newsstands. They got all the media attention. And now all of a sudden, here's this platform where people can learn that there's a whole other side of the sport that's drug-free and that they can do this and have fun and enjoy it without all that extra, right? Mm-hmm. So I do owe social media a lot of credit for growing the OCB, bringing it to people's awareness. So in that respect, it's been a positive thing. I do think that for some people, it can become an obsession. When you're feeling good about yourself and you want to take those selfies and share them, there's nothing really wrong with that. But, we know that the research coming from, you know, coming out about Instagram and Facebook, that it's toxic for our kids and it's toxic for our adults.
It sure is.
And so the amount of time that people are spending at curating their photos and making their social media look perfect. And it is concerning because, you know, perhaps in some organizations, it's important for them to have 100,000 followers. It's not relevant with us.
Right.
When you get on stage, we're not looking at your social media. We're not looking at, you know,
how many times you tagged the OCB to make sure that you participated enough in the social media game.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. And so it's, it doesn't factor into anything for us other than, you know, we appreciate when athletes post and say they had a great time at our shows and all of that, but we just don't want people making themselves sick over it, you know, emotionally sick over it. All the filters and all this stuff.
I don't even know how to use filters, but it's, and I tell people the same thing because I get asked this question all the time. How do you feel social media has influenced? And I say exactly the same thing. It's been a blessing and a curse. It's been a blessing in the sense that it has opened the sport to so many more people, but it's a curse in the exact same way, right? I mean, it's so not just the breeding ground for the comparison game and the, I don't look like that person. And, you know, why is that person lean all year? And I'm not. So, you know, the sport in and of itself is a breeding ground for, you know, disordered eating and body dysmorphia and all of those things. And so social media is just the catalyst for that. And, but in every respect, right? So I think social media is a blessing and a curse in every realm, right? Like, it's a blessing that we get to see cat pictures and puppy dog pictures, and then it's a curse that we get to have to see political bullshit, right? So it's like, so it's I think it's that it's a blessing and a curse for everything. It's have the ability to share information, but then, you know, it's you also have the ability to, you know, to really have a negative impact. So it's a matter of, I know for me as a coach, I try to be very responsible with my athletes and coaching them through all of those aspects, right? So it's not just, I'm not just throwing macros and cardio at clients. It's like, I am coaching them through how to handle social media and, you know, how to get the fuck off of it if you can't manage it, right? And all of the things that,
or if you know, you know somebody you're competing against, like I think that the sport would have been a lot healthier in some respects when people didn't know who else they were going up against until they got to the show. Like, just bring your freaking best.
Yeah.
Don't worry about anybody else. But now it's like people are putting themselves out there and, you know, nobody posts an unflattering photo. Okay. So they're all trying to post these photos where, you know, they're dealt.
I'm not competing. So
But you know, they're you know, presenting themselves in a way that, you know, when you see them in person, you're like, wait, that person don't look anything like those pictures they're posting. You know, how many times has that happened? Right.
Well, I mean, for me as a coach, I'm guilty of it. Like me as a coach, right? Like I'm like, sometimes when the competitor list comes out, I'm like, okay, who's going to be their competition? Who's going to be their competition? Sure. Right. So I start, it's funny. Cause when a list for a show comes out, you start getting all kinds of friend requests. I'm like, what is this?
Right. Oh yeah.
Right. But I'll look and, you know, I eventually stopped. I did that, you know, early on, but I eventually stopped. Cause I was like, I would see these people. I'm like, oh man, they look great. And I'm like, you know, and I'd start getting nervous for my client. Of course, I don't say anything to them. This is just me now having my own anxiety attack. I get to the show and I was like, you don't look anything like you did on social media.
The person doesn't even know how to pose, right?
I was like, who was that in your picture? Because that doesn't look like you, right? It's just like, okay. So I don't even pay any attention to it anymore. Even as a coach, I don't bother.
But it does bring people together too.
It does.
So it, you know, it's, I guess it's all how you utilize it, you know,
you have to be a responsible consumer of information, right? I mean, it comes down to responsibility of the person and managing your own self, right? So we are not here to babysit everybody on social media and, you know, so it's social media literacy, right? You just have to understand how to manage it.
Yeah. So, and I just want to say as a public statement on behalf of OCB, we do not care whether or not you have social media or not. We do not care how many followers you have. We don't care how many codes you have. We don't care about any of that. We just want you to come to our shows, have a great time, do your best, and whatever you bring to the stage is all that matters.
Yep. I tell my clients that all the time.
So I hope you all feel better now.
Everybody can put down the hashtags. For the love of baby Jesus, put the hashtags away. I'm like, Jesus, these hashtags. All right. So here's a question. What is something that surprised you your first time competing that you wish someone would have told you about beforehand? Sully, you go first. Your first time competing, if you can remember back that long, in 2000 AD.
I remember 1979 very, very, very well. The two things they forgot to tell me about was one was the day before the show, because this is before we had all these fancy dyes and tans and whatever. You just kind of like laid out in the sun, and then you had this orange stuff you kind of put on the day before. Oh, but you had to shave your body beforehand. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever explained to me about having to do that.
Do you have
that
pictures?
That to me was still the...
Do you have pictures?
I go to a cave in France. I'm carved in, and I said, yeah, you know, next to a caribou or the guy with a spear. The second thing was, is that after 18 weeks of dieting, nobody told me what my body would do after I got done eating those two Big Macs and a large fry and a milkshake at McDonald's. Okay. So those are the two things that nobody ever told me about, you know, returning back to a normal diet, the slingshot. As a matter of fact, Tina, you and I talked a lot about it, you know, back when we were working together, and I know you do it with your clients, but one of the things that nobody ever talked about until really 15 years ago was the end game coming off of your comp test diet. Everybody just went from 0 to 1,000. We'd all get sick. We'd all be bloated. It was just a miserable experience for days.
We were taking pictures of our food baby bellies afterwards. Like it was like some prized possession. I mean,
But when you do it after your first show, if nobody explains that to you and you do it after your first show, first the shaving thing, horrible. And after the first show, getting that first taste of real food and how sick you are about 4 hours later.
Yep.
Yeah. Nobody briefed me on those. Those are two memories I'll cherish forever.
And I will say, I think there are still some people that I never understand how they don't research and understand the shaving thing, but I've seen people showing up unshaved. Oh, so it's still happening. There's no excuse for it anymore, but it's still happening. And the food thing is also still happening because there's a lot of coaches that do not explain that. I have unfortunately run into a lot of people whose coaches told them to eat whatever they want for an entire week after the show. And again, I've seen people end up in the hospital, and I mean, it's really a whole nightmare, but those things still happen, unfortunately, you know, but those are good. What about you, Marjorie? The first time you competed, what was the thing that surprised you?
I didn't have a coach. I had just some friends, and we all decided we were going to do this together. So I knew I needed a spray tan. So I just went for like a regular spray tan. And I thought I was good. I'm like, I'm dark. I got a nice tan. I was white as white could be. Like, if you look at my pictures, they're reflecting, you know? And then the other thing was, okay, let's see. Posing. Oh my gosh. You probably won't see a photo of my first show.
You got to show it. If Sully can dig up his hairy ass picture from 1979, you have to I'll dig up one of my first pictures. You dig up one of your first pictures, and we'll all put our first pictures
out there. I did not know how to pose at all. Or I didn't even really know what they were looking at. It's just like, I'm going to get up there, I'm going to do this and this like thing. And my hair looks good. My jewelry's cute. And I got a nice little suit. But yeah, the tan, don't mess with the tan. You know what? Some people do the pro tan, or they do the, what's it called?
Dream tan.
Dream tan.
Okay.
Good old dream tan.
My brain is already so messed up by the time it's show day. I'm just like, somebody else has got to do this for me. I don't want to do anything.
It didn't exist when I was competing. Tanners when we were competing.
Wouldn't that have been awesome? Loved that.
So it was like this whole
instead
thing.
Instead of this with the dream tan.
Oh my God, the fucking dream tan and smacking everybody around. And then you should see like Eric and I, and even, you know, early on, again, before spray tanning was really a thing, like my first show, God bless my poor mother-in-law. My husband had to work. So she had to tan me. And so I was butt ass naked, bent over, and she's rolling on the, I think it was probably Jantana or something. I don't even know, but we always did our own tans because their spray tanning wasn't a thing yet. So I tell all my clients now, I'm just like, please just use the spray tanner it's worth the money. Yes. I'm going to tell you right now,
there are some things in life you don't cut corners on. Nope. And if they got a spray tanner at the show,
if all I had to do was stand in a tent for 20 minutes with a sock over my junk,
because it was an all day process for me. I mean, it literally was paid, my, entire
paid
Friday.
$500 for that.
Okay. I absolutely would have. It was our entire like Friday. Mm. It was like a coat in the morning, a coat in the afternoon. Oh my God. It was just a freaking nightmare.
Well, I don't know. Like some things you are just worth paying money for. And I know athletes are trying to, you know, cut corners and everything. Don't cut corners on your tan and go get professional posing help.
Absolutely.
Please.
I am very grateful that just because I researched the hell out of competing before I stepped on stage in 2005 for the first time. So I hired a posing coach. I had a nutrition coach. She wasn't a very good one, but I had a nutrition coach. I had to kiss some frogs before I found some good coaches. But I had, I at least had that. So I felt like I was confident in those areas. But I think my one thing is definitely I really wish reverse dieting was a thing when I was coming up in the sport. I really wish I hadn't had to suffer through what became a binge eating disorder, because it was diet, compete, binge, diet, compete, binge for years and years. So I think that's probably one of the biggest things that is so important for me teaching clients now. Yeah, that one was kind of a shocker, but it's just, it's just what we did. I tell people all the time, like, it's nobody's fault. It's just, nobody knew, right? Like, it's not what we were doing back then. So, all right, what else? Oh, I know. I had a couple questions about, like, what is up with everybody failing for SARMs? What is happening?
SARMs is like a very popular thing.
It is, but it seems like it came out of nowhere all of a sudden. Like, what's happening?
Well, we were not sharing our failures for years. So we've always had failures. We just never posted about them because we didn't want to put people on blast. Like, some organizations will put the name out there, but there are a lot of people who fail for a variety of reasons that really aren't intentional. Sometimes they just don't read. Okay, we know there are people who don't read. And we know, and so when they polygraph, they think that they're good, or, we had someone who failed for diuretics last year because her coach gave her something after her polygraph. She didn't know what it was because, some of these people, they just trust the process. When they say trust the process, just like, just do whatever I tell you. That's the key sometimes, And so then she failed for diuretics. So, was she doing that on purpose? No. So there are instances where people fail, where it's like, do you need to ruin somebody's life because they failed a urinalysis? So we just never published the information before. The vast majority of failures are during the polygraph process, not the urinalysis, which is ideal because you want to keep people from getting on stage to begin with.
Right. Because then you're not taking somebody's moment away from them on stage when you have to reverse everything. Because Lord knows we had to do that this year.
So I know there's like always, I know you're a believer in polygraph, but for people who don't really understand it, one is that, most people won't try to bypass that. They're not going to diet for 15 to 20 weeks to have to go sit in a seat to potentially fail a polygraph. So it does deter people from trying to cheat. When people do come for polygraph, and Sully does it regularly, there's a discussion that takes place, before you're even hooked up to anything. Did you look over the banned substance list? Like, the vast majority of the time, it's during that conversation that something comes out.
Yeah, right? You never even have to polygraph them because they just admit and they're like, oh shit, I'm taking this thing. And
I bet as an organization, I bet we get 8 of those a year.
Yep.
Easy. 7 or 8.
And the one that we just recently had, we just had our first show of the season right out of the gate. The athlete couldn't remember. He took a supplement. He couldn't remember what it was because he was worried that he might not pass because he was nervous about it, right? So he pulls up the supplement, pull it up right out of the gate. SARMs, right on the label. So, you can't. That's not, coercion. That's not, somebody saying you can't compete because we pinged you 3 times. It's the process works. It's effective. If it were the only thing that was effective, then we wouldn't bother urinalysis testing. So it's like we get them before, we get them when they step off stage with the urinalysis. And then we're also doing random and targeted off season. So like if we get a tip, we're going to follow up on it.
Yeah. And again, you know, like I've been back and forth on polygraphs over the years, but they are a deterrent, and that is all they're meant to be. Right. So it's because you're right. Most people, yes, there are people out there that will intentionally come to an OCB show with plans of beating a polygraph. You will have those people, but most people aren't, right? So it is going to be a deterrent for most people. And then you catch them on the, you know, if they do get through the polygraph and they win, if they're in a position that that really matters, then they're going to get popped on the urinalysis, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are ways to beat every system. There are, right? And I worked for the government for 15 years. I had to take a top secret, you know, lifestyle poly that was fucking 5 hours long, like every couple of years, right? And so I get it, right? They're not admissible in court. We all know that. Mm-hmm. But they are used for a particular reason in, you know, particular careers and, you know, things. And there's no reason not to use it in bodybuilding. And as again, if you don't want to pay the $50 polygraph fee or take a polygraph, go compete somewhere else, right? There are places to compete that don't polygraph. We don't need to, if you don't like the muffins at Starbucks, go to Dunkin' Donuts.
Exactly. I mean, exactly.
It's that simple.
So I just have two things. One thing on the SARMs, it's become more prevalent to take because there are some laboratories that you can compete in the federation that'll use a laboratory that either doesn't test for SARMs, they'll only test for maybe one SARM. The laboratory we use, it will hit every single SARM that's known to man. It's an IOC laboratory. So they'll come in having passed the urinalysis test somewhere else and then come in to, you know, our drug testing procedure and get caught. So that does happen. The other thing is that they're so prevalent out there in supplements that they're being, competitors are being swayed into taking them, thinking them that they're no more than just a supplement.
And then
they take them and then, oh crap, I never read the banned substance list. And, you know, I got through the polygraph because it didn't register to me that I took anything. And, you know, then they get nailed in the urinalysis. So that's why you're seeing a little bit more of them. But just because it's more widespread, the use is more widespread, it's more available, kind of just like Andro was, you know, for a while. But onto the polygraph, there's two things I want to say about the polygraph. Number one, the polygraph is used as a screen, as a deterrent, but it's also a successful tool. Every year I report my results to Marjorie. I'll have a good number of failures every year, but I also have what's called admission. So I'll give somebody a polygraph exam. I'll get a failure. You know, I'll give them a second attempt at the test. I change my questioning set. I go from, you know, a little bit more laid back approach to a different approach. There's a million different ways to orchestrate the test. There's a million different ways that you could administer the test. They're all done for a reason to indicate a different, you know, a response a different way. About the third bite at the apple, a lot of times you'll get into a more interrogative process and I'll get admissions. The admission is usually something to the effect of, I kind of might have sort of maybe might have taken one thing, could have been maybe 6.5 years ago, kind of could have been maybe. And I think that maybe that's what I'm talking about. Okay, no, what that's called is mitigation. You've just mitigated the culpability because you're embarrassed right now, but you are cheating coming in. That's a person that we've removed from contention of robbing somebody else from a placement. So anytime I hear, why do you polygraph? Because on the admission end, our network of polygraphers, and it's not just contrary to popular belief, we don't just have like one or two people who polygraph for the OCB, we have like 9 or 10. We have a whole network, people who have worked for the FBI, people working criminal investigations in Florida, people doing background investigations. We give them a weekend gig doing here, criminal investigations is in my case. So we have that network. So as a collective, we'll have 15, 20, 25 admissions by the end of a year cumulatively. That's 15 or 20 people that cheated to get in there that might have been third place robbing somebody. Mm-hmm. But we also hear about the person who they know cheated through a polygraph exam. Yes, it happens. And you know something? I know a guy who lived to be 108 and smoked 19 packs of cigarettes a day and drank a fifth of Jack Daniels. They're out there, people. They're called anomalies. That's one of the reasons why. There's a whole litany of people who can pass a polygraph That comes out to a small segment of the population, but it's still, they're still out there. Mm-hmm. Another thing that happens is our threshold and you don't really fail a polygraph, there's indicators that you're being dishonest on a question. You're just following the indicators, just reading the chart. But our threshold is fairly high. And there are times, and I chart this every time, that I have people who indicate high. And the indication's a little high because we would rather have an innocent person get through the polygraph, or a guilty person, sorry, we'd rather have a guilty person be at that threshold but not cross it and get through that we can catch on a year analysis test than to have the threshold too low and send innocent people home. So we don't, as an OCB, we didn't set the threshold. It's just an industry standard. So I'm just explaining how polygraphs work. So right. It's a scoring system. Plus three is bad. Anything below a plus three is good. People who are polygraph examiners understand that. So the threshold's set for that reason. So you don't want the guilty, innocent people. But you have people that indicate really, really high. And I'll mark that. And a number of times, somebody who's indicated high but not quite over that threshold will end up failing on a year analysis test. And we target that. I'll look at that. I'll walk around with an extra vial and go, maybe I need to do a random year analysis mm-hmm. test. If I'm looking at this person and my eyeball is telling me something because they indicated high, mm-hmm. but they managed to be below the threshold. So yeah, there are a lot of nuances with the polygraph that you can talk about for that 2-3%. But for 97% of the people who take the polygraph exam, it's a good tool. It weeds out 20 or more known cheaters per year. And for me, that's worth the price of admission.
Last year was the first year that, I said, why aren't we sharing this data? Let's just share it. Yeah. Like in real time, when we get a failure, the examiners will send me an email and be like, I just got a failure.
And we let them know if it was also an admission. Is it somebody we've tested 2-3 times and they finally admitted to something? And that's an admission, because you can have a failure and somebody can have a bad day and fail, and they can go back and they can pass another polygraph exam for a variety of factors. There's all kinds of intrinsic factors. It's a rarity. It doesn't happen frequently, but there is that possibility that it can happen.
Right. Yeah.
We're talking about the people that on the second test come around, they admit. And we have that information.
And once again, I mean, really, that the moral of the story is, if you don't want to take a polygraph, then just go somewhere else. It is what it is. No amount of arguing or bitching or moaning about it is going to have you change. It's not going to get change.
Yeah, right? Really like Starbucks to sell Dunkin' Donuts, but that's not going to happen.
Exactly. See, Marjorie, it's just Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts. I don't know why it's so hard. Or Taco Bell and Burger King.
If you don't want a burrito, don't go to Taco Bell.
Although I think Burger King might have burritos now, and I don't know. We'll call it Taco King or Burger Bell. I don't know. Whatever.
Well, anyway, it's something that we stand by and that we believe in. And if people don't like it, then that's not the place for them. But it's effective for us, and it makes us feel better about our athletes.
And we have 20 years of data that shows that we've probably weeded out over 20 years, 200 people with admissions.
Yeah.
That's 200 people that would have stayed in the organization cheating and removing placements from everybody else. That's why we do it.
Data. It's all data. And I will tell you that I appreciate how much, of that, the data, you're sharing. And I think that putting this out here on the podcast today, I think it's going to help people understand it more, because we're getting a little peek behind the curtain and how the sausage mm-hmm. is made. And I think that's important because I was talking to Bobby about this today, and Marjorie, I think I've talked to you about this. Like we were talking a little bit at Jordan Cup, and I've done every role in a federate, right? Like I've judged and I've competed and I've been a pro and I've been an amateur and I've been a promoter, right? And in another federation. So I've done all the things. And so I understand how all the things work. So I understand what goes into promoting a show. So do I love all of the venues? No, but do I appreciate what a promoter put into getting there because I appreciate the hassle and how hard it is to get these things. I told you that at Yorton Cup. I was like, I can't imagine this was easy. I appreciate what you did, right? Did I love everything about it? No, but that's okay, right? Like, it's just, I can appreciate it. And I think it's important for people who really want to be in this sport as an athlete to educate themselves and to learn about what goes on behind the scenes, right? So, and I think it's really important that you guys are willing to put this information out there because it does, you know, again, it sort of lifts the veil a little bit. People have a better understanding. They may be less likely to bitch and moan about something when they know how hard, you know, really where your heart is, what you're doing. We're talking about data. Some people won't give a fuck about data. I get it. Like, I'm a data person, so it makes a difference to me. I would do surveys and what do people want? And like, you know, I'm all about all of those things, but, I really appreciate that you guys were open and, you know, sharing all of this information with everybody. And I do think people will appreciate it as well. I know it's the kind of thing that's important to me. And I think you guys are doing a great job personally. And I, you know, appreciate that you guys were here with me tonight. It's getting a little bit late and I think Sully needs to go to Taco Bell and Marjorie needs to get up early for Starbucks. and it's time for me. I gotta go watch the last episode of Ozark.
And I'm not saying a word.
Don't, because I'm on I'm on the last episode and my mother-in-law's already tried to spoil it twice.
But there's another half of the season.
I know. It's not the end.
Okay.
So my husband is probably down there pacing right now. It's like 7:30. She should be, because at 7:30 I'm on the couch drinking my sleepy time tea because I am that old. And then I'm in bed by like 8:30. So he's probably like, where is she? Anyway. Thank you guys so much for hanging out with me tonight. Is there any like really quick last minute parting thoughts before we say goodbye?
We're really excited about the 2022 contest season. We look forward to having all the competitors join us this year. Don't hesitate to reach out and ask questions. You know, or direct message, over social media, totally fine. We love to be there for you. You can click the contact us button, reach Sully there and answer the email questions you have. We're always available to answer those questions. So don't hesitate to reach out.
And none of us are ever afraid to explain the why to people. You know, we want to let people know the why. We just don't, you know, we understand that if we don't tell people why we do things, somebody's going to make up the narrative anyway. So we'd rather just have
each other. They'll still make up the narrative even when you tell them.
Yeah, you know what? I don't even pay attention to the noise. You know, no. I don't pay attention to the noise. I'm too focused on trying to make this the best. I mean, Marjorie and I text each other 20 times a day. Hey, I got this idea. What do you think about doing this? Maybe we could do this and this will be better. And then Marjorie would be like, well, what about this? What about, you know, I mean, the good idea fairies are always laying eggs in our heads, but it's all in one effort, in one true effort. And that's just to try to put out the best product possible because we've gotten so much out of this sport, many contacts, so many friendships, so many memories, so much positivity that just want to give a little bit back and make it a great experience.
I want to say thank you to all the promoters in the OCB who work so hard to make sure that all these things that are supposed to happen at their shows, and they believe in the process and they trust in what we're doing and our goal and our mission, because if they didn't, they wouldn't be here. They're just as passionate about it as we are. And so we're really grateful to all of them.
Yeah, we're a great family.
Yep.
It more or less is like a family.
And while I am not technically an OCB family member, I mean, obviously it's where I have family in the OCB. Mm-hmm. And while my clients do compete wherever, I do not make my clients compete anywhere. Right. But, I do, you know, there is the occasion where wherever they live, there just isn't a show and they're not traveling. So, you know, we do what we find the best thing for them. I have had other promoters reach out to me and I'm like, okay, well, I just got to see how your show is first. And then I'll decide if I want to recommend it to my athletes, because as a coach, it does me no good to put my client in a show where they're not going to have a good experience or they're, you know, not going to have any kind of competition. And again, it depends on the client. You know, most of my clients, they're paying me a lot of money to give them the competition experience that they deserve, right? And if they're putting in all of this work, you know, for better or worse, nobody wants to stand on stage by themselves. And so I have to consider those, all of those factors come into play when I'm helping my clients choose shows, right? So contrary to some things I've heard, you know, on the social about me, I am not a bully who tells their clients to only compete in certain shows. My clients have the freedom to go wherever they want. And
I'm a bully too. That's probably why we get along so well.
Maybe. I mean,
it's the short girl thing.
It might be. I mean, we're just mean girls, Marjorie. Oh. I don't know. No, I just, you know, I tell it like it is. It is what it is. And like I said, it's a business. I understand business. I think you guys are doing a great job by the athletes and putting back into the athletes, you know? So I get it. And I thank you for being with me. Oh, and I'm really excited to start doing some posing classes here coming up soon. Hey. So I do. I guess I better not forget my own shameless self-promotion, if I can say the words. So I'm getting back into group posing. I stopped doing it for a while. I'm focusing on private posing. But so we have a couple of sessions coming up soon here in the we'll call it the Baltimore, Washington area, right? So the suburbs here. But you can check out our website. We'll put all the resources and stuff.
Yeah, there's a huge need for OCB clinics up there. So Tina, thank you for filling that. And she reached out to me and said, I think I want to host clinics again. Maybe I'm going to do that. I'm like, please do, because we definitely could use that. And we appreciate all the work you do with competitors. And we know that you're going to take good care of them and keep them on the natural path. And so that's what matters most.
And help them not look like idiots on stage.
Right, exactly.
Right? So that they don't end up on stage without a tan and no posing like your first experience, Marjorie. All right, guys. Thank you so much. And I hope you have a great night. And what we always say here on the podcast is don't get weird. Use your head. It'll all be okay. Bye.
Bye.
Bye now.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Coaching and Cocktails, the podcast. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you like to stream your favorites. Bye.